Probably many of us on Thursday saw some of the hearings from the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th, 2021, quote unquote, insurrection. How many people saw at least some part of that? Right. And it's a very, that like many other things in the country, it's a very polarized situation with many people ignoring the hearings, Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. Their only comment was a three-word tweet, all full sentences, all period, old period news, period. That was the only comment. And so there's, you know, clearly with that issue and many others, very much evidence of deep polarization. One of the, you know, one of the ways we can see a kind of crisis in this country, and I think it's similar in some other countries, polarization, lack of communication, lack of skill related to, in our country, political paralysis around key issues that have to be acted on, like the climate emergency or gun violence, voter suppression and racism. So I want to ask the question today, and I may very likely continue next time, what is our Dharma response to polarization? And really working with differences and conflicts. How does our Dharma practice give us some wisdom and guidance for working with situations of polarization, difference, and conflict? And my starting point is going to be pointing out that skill in working with differences and conflicts and polarization is not limited to the U.S. Congress. It's not limited to the sort of the national political scene. You know, that I've seen, and probably many of us have seen, that this is actually, it's a very deep underlying condition, I think very much in our current country, but I think it's something that's very much general and found in so many settings, including in spiritual settings. And so just a few observations before going more fully into looking into how we might approach this from Dharma. And one of those observations is seeing that people in social change organizations are often not very skillful as well in terms of working with differences and conflicts. I remember leading a workshop at a conference that took place in Berkeley on the theme of spiritual activism. And I was giving a workshop on what's a curriculum for spiritual activists. I'm trying to outline that. But first I wanted to find out information from people about what their experiences were. And I remember asking them, what are some of the issues that you want help with? And probably the predominant response was, in our groups and organizations, we have so much conflict. We don't treat each other well. We get angry with each other. We're self-righteous, attached to views, and so forth, right? And that's, I think, very common. We can see that sometimes from the inside, sometimes from the outside. A lot of self-righteousness, we would say, from Buddhist perspective, attachment to views. You know, one manifestation of this would be maybe what we sometimes call cancel culture. I've been particularly noticing when I listen, as I listen often, to the radio station KPFA, which is, of course, a so-called progressive station. And what I've particularly noticed with people talking about issues where I might actually agree with their perspectives is how uncommon it is for people representing a certain perspective to have any empathy towards their opponents or to actually represent in a sympathetic way the opposing view. More often, there's demonization. There's a creating to some extent of a straw man or a straw person, not really sympathetically understanding the opponent. And I've seen that over and over again, including, you know, in people talking, in emails I get. You know, with many of the issues I care a lot about, you know, I've been active some recently in Middle East issues, Israel-Palestine issues, and I see that all the time, even with groups that, you know, where I can learn from. It's very uncommon to be empathic and compassionate towards opponents. And interestingly, we can really contrast this with the approach that we get, let's say, from Dr. King, who speaks of the beloved community. And like Gandhi said that our long-term aim is to have our opponents become friends. And for King, it was to be a member of the beloved community. He said, this is from Dr. King, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community." It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of human beings. So that's a very different approach. So I see that, and you can see that if you study the life of Dr. King, you can see continual empathy towards people who were seemingly his opponents. For him, it was particularly towards poor white people, right? Tremendous level of empathy. And I'm sorry to say that I see this lack of clear intention and skill in working with differences and conflicts very commonly in spiritual settings as well. I'm sorry to say that, but it's what I find. I find that in many of the communities connected with insight meditation, some of you know that there were really significant differences and conflicts in the monastery connected with Achan Cha in England, so much so that they said, we need some tools, and they brought in trainers in nonviolent communication because they found they really were not skillful when there were differences. I've seen that also, sometimes from a distance, sometimes pretty close up, with the Insight Meditation Society and with Spirit Rock, right? That we often have not been skillful with differences and conflicts. And I'm sorry to say that we don't even for the teachers have guidelines, as some Dharma centers do, on how to work with differences and conflicts. And I think it's partly that we're fairly underdeveloped in terms of what we might call relational practices, generally, you know, wise speech and ways of being in relationship. Again, there's a more of a focus on individual practice as part of the roots. And of course, we also, I'll talk in a moment about some other reasons for these, really these lack of skillful approaches to conflict and differences. And of course, we also find that in our extended families, with our friends, in our communities, we find often that when there's a difference or conflict, I find this very commonly, people either don't know how to or don't want to work out problems And so we often, relationships end, or relationships stay stuck. How many can relate to this in your own experience of finding that? And it's a very common experience. So how do we understand that from a Dharma perspective, and what kind of tools can we use? And so I think it's helpful to know that there are a number of systemic reasons, a lot of them culturally based, why this is the case. One of them is that there's very, very common conditioning in our culture to be either conflict avoidant or conflict indulgent. Conflict avoidance is probably, when in meditation circles, is the bigger one for whatever reason. I think maybe, not sure why, but when I do polls, because I sometimes teach on, I do sometimes do trainings on working with conflict, and I do polls, and this is the people who show up. I do polls, and about 2/3 or 3/4 of them say their conditioning was to be conflict avoidant. That was my conditioning. And I'll talk about that in a moment later. How many of us had conditioning to be conflict avoidant? Yes, that's most of us. The other possible conditioning is to be what we might call conflict indulgent. This is just to jump into conflicts. And I think to some extent, this is determined culturally, that in terms of people from European background, people who are from Northern and Western Europe tend to be more conflict avoidant. And that has become the larger culture of the United States. And people from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe tend to be conflict indulgent, right? And that's, but again, when we get to the United States, it changes. So I lived in Boston for a time in Little Italy with people who are recently from Italy, come from Italy. And this was the north end of Boston. Some of you probably know that. And during the summer, all the apartment windows were open, and the conflicts were just, could be heard a block away. They're right out there. No one was conflict avoidant in those circles. Maybe a generation later, yes. Because that's probably, like, for me, coming with my ancestors from Eastern Europe, I would say, was more conflict indulgent. You sometimes see that with people who grew up in New York. Right. But from people who are Jewish particularly. But, one generation for me, and it was conflict avoidance, right? It's interesting, right? It changes. And I'll just mention a little footnote. There was a really interesting book about psychoanalysis, which said that the basis for Freud's theory of the unconscious was his perception. This is a theory, I'm not sure if it's accurate, but was Freud's sense of a discrepancy between what he knew from Eastern Europe and more Eastern Europe Jewish culture, and then what he found in Vienna, which was repressed, right? And the conflicts were beneath the surface. And some people say that discrepancy gave him insight that helped him develop the notion of the unconscious. Interesting, right? Interesting theory. And so knowing someone's conflict style can be very interesting. Some of you know John Gottman, who writes about relationships. Anyone know John Gottman's work? Probably some of you do. And John Gottman said he could be with a couple, and in 3 minutes could get enough information to make a prediction that he found had 94% accuracy about whether the couple would be together in 3 years. What he honed in on was whether they had a shared conflict style. And once he figured that out, he knew what was happening, because he found out that what's most important for a couple to stay together isn't that they're really skilled at conflict, but it's that they have the same conflict style. So two conflict avoidant people can do very well together because they share the avoidance. And two indulgent people can just, you know, get into it, and they have the style. You have a conflict avoidant and a conflict indulgent, the relationship will likely not last. Interesting, right? So that's Gottman. So just a few other factors that make it hard for us to be with conflict. There are very strong cultural tendencies towards conflicts ending up with winners and losers, as in sports. You know, do you remember when there was an all-star game in which there was a tie, how much this was traumatic for sports fans, right? And so there are these very strong cultural pressures to have winners or losers, we might say, towards a dualistic model of conflict. And of course, other ones are familiar, and this starts to point to where we might come in with Dharma practice. We get attached to outcomes in conflict. We get attached to our views. We become reactive. We, you know, we're involved with anger or being judgmental or fear or just different forms of reactivity related to the conflict. And, you know, and I think anger is an especially significant one because, again, one of the reasons in Buddhist settings that conflicts are difficult is that there are many ways in which anger is not well understood, and it's often suppressed, even in the translations from the Buddhist text. I think anger is mistranslated, for example, as a translation of dosa, one of the three so-called poisons. You know, closer to ill will is a much better translation. You'll find it often translated as anger. And in many settings, if you listen to Dharma talks, I hear this with other Dharma teachers, anger is seen as just entirely negative, which is very, very confusing for people. Because in the Western tradition, anger is often something that can be a sign that a boundary is being violated. And culturally, it's often something that's positive. You know, after all, who gets angry in Western culture? Well, God, Jesus, the Jewish prophets, we could go on. And so anyway, these are just some of the reasons why we get very, very confused and incapable about working with conflict. And so how to have a Dharma perspective that helps us work with conflict. One starting point is to have a sense of conflict not in the way that it's usually understood culturally, which is as something involving aggression or hostility, but rather if we reframe conflict as simply a difference in values or needs or perspectives, rather than necessarily involving hostility. We may even want to use a different term, because most people hear the word conflict and it has connotations of hostility and maybe even aggression. And so we can reframe conflict so that it's about difference. And then we can bring our tools in, our different practice tools, to have the perspective of working with differences, you know, and we could say initially between people. And how do we work with another person who has a different perspective? First of all, we can reframe it as not necessarily a problem. We can suggest that it's even possible to take differences as the starting point for a learning process, whether it's a learning process about the issue at hand, such that dialogue and inquiry and careful listening can lead me to have a different perspective than I had earlier. Or that it could be where there actually are real differences, we might be able to value the relationship and try to find a resolution that meets the needs, let's say in the case of two people, of both of us, rather than just mine. And so a very important perspective is to have an approach to conflict and difference in which we're looking for what sometimes is called a both and or a win-win solution, in which we meet the needs of both parties rather than trying to win. And to, you know, to do that, we really need to have a lot of Dharma tools, such as the ability to listen carefully, to listen with empathy, to practice wise speech. I'll go into these in a little more depth. But let me show a little bit. I'm going to do a share screen and say a little bit more about this model of really pointing towards a both and or win-win model. Let's see if I can do this. Okay. Okay, here's my handout. Let's see if I can get this on. Okay. Oops, that didn't seem to work. Can you see my handout here easily? Okay, let me stop that. Okay, maybe I, yeah, that wasn't, could you see that okay? Or was it, did you see a kind of a split screen as I did? Okay, let me not, so one way of talking about an approach to conflict, sort of pointing towards the goal, is to say there are, in any conflict, let's say with two people, there are needs of both parties. What we'll tend to do is just tend, if we're attached to the views, I'll tend to think I'm right, you're wrong. And the approach here is to empathically listen to the need of the other party. And then the aim is, can we find a resolution that meets the needs of both parties rather than just meeting my needs? Very simple idea, which a lot of us practice in our relationships, but it's helpful to have this as a kind of formal model, because the usual approach is to just have, when we have a conflict between two parties, let's say, the usual tendency is to try to get my needs met, and I forget about the other party. So here, we try to understand the needs of the other, and if possible, come to a win-win. In some situations, we can't get there immediately. Sometimes we need first to look for a compromise. And if we're really in a difficult place and hostile, sometimes we need to have first a time out. But what we're looking for in the long run is the ability to be sensitive to the needs of the others and to be able to find a resolution which meets the needs of others. Now, very important to have a sense that need needs to be defined a little bit more. And here I use the definition that comes from nonviolent communication, that the needs are something that are kind of universally valid. We try to tune in a sense, is there a universally valid need? So it wouldn't be a need to get my way, but it would be a need to, to have physical security, or to have autonomy or freedom, or to have, some way of being recognized. And so that distinction is really important, because, again, the nonviolent communication, they have a very nice way of talking about it. They distinguish between needs and strategies. And strategies can be unskillful, and needs are always valid in a sense. So an alcoholic has a need for peace, very legitimate, but the strategy is unskillful. So sometimes in working with conflicts, we want to tune in to what's legitimate about the need, even and not be totally totally focusing on the unskillful strategy, right? So that's something really, really crucial, that there are needs, even something, you know, like I think about the Middle East and Israel-Palestine, even if there are a lot of ways that one could criticize Israel, for example, there are legitimate needs for security. There are legitimate needs there. And so often the conflict doesn't even recognize what legitimate needs are, that just focus on the unskillful strategy and don't listen empathically to the need. So I'll just mention a few tools that are part of our practice. I think empathy is a starting point, the ability to listen. You know, when I've studied working with conflict with a great conflict theorist and an activist named Johann Galtung, and he said that someone who works skillfully with conflict, the starting capacity is empathy and the ability to listen, you know, without projecting our views on the other. I think ultimately to listen to the needs. And in fact, when I, along with my colleague Oren J. Sofer, when we have worked out what we call empathy practice based on nonviolent communication, which I think I've sometimes taught for Marin Sangha, we take empathy as the tuning in first to the emotions present and then to the underlying needs. And that's a practice which we can work with on a daily basis. So, and so that could be done. So, so for example, if I was talking about something and invited you to be empathic towards me, I might say, okay, listen right now from what the emotions are for me and for my underlying needs. Okay, I'll talk for about 1 minute. Listen, this is your empathy practice. Okay, tune in to my emotions, tune in to my underlying needs. Okay, yesterday we had a family gathering in Petaluma. My nephew and his wife are expecting a child in August. And so there was a gathering of 40 people. I hadn't seen my nephew, who lives in Los Angeles, for some time. It was really nice to see, just gathering around, a lot of connection, really good food. Cameron's wife, Sammy's mother, made really, really nice cheesecake with fruit. Really good. Okay, cut. Okay, what were some of the emotions that you noticed? You can just speak up.
Pride and pleasure.
What?
Pride in your family and pleasure.
Pride, pleasure, yeah. What else?
Gratitude.
Joy.
A kind of longing.
Yeah, kind of longing to connect. Yeah, very good. So you're noticing things I didn't even notice. And then in terms of needs, what were some needs?
Good food.
Yeah, nourishment.
Connection.
And what else?
Belonging,
I think, yeah.
Belonging.
Belonging, yeah. And I think probably good communication. So this is the empathy practice, which I'll invite you to do until the next time I come, and possibly for the rest of your lives. Okay? It's your call. But when you have a difference or conflict, do empathy practice like this. Make a commitment to radical empathy, right? In when there are differences, it's also very good when there are not differences or conflicts. So this is one way we can practice. It's a listening, a tuning in A second way we practice is noticing that if there are attachment to views. We could take a whole session on this, but look for when there are differences, particularly, am I attached to a view? Could be a political view, could be a view about the best way to handle a situation. I could go into more depth on that. A third way of practicing, number one, empathy. Number two, practicing with views. Number three, practicing with reactivity, of course. Practicing with anger or being judgmental. And so, again, this is very direct use of our practice. When there's a difference or a conflict, bring these tools in. What would it be like if the U.S. Congress was practicing as their first priority, empathy, non-attachment to views, and practicing with reactivity? Well, why not?
Not going to happen.
Right. And then maybe lastly, I'll just mention the heart practices. We want to, what I found in teaching on differences and conflicts is that when there are such differences, heart practices can be very helpful, and particularly compassion practice and forgiveness practice. For some of us, we may do metta in a certain way that works, but particularly when we have a difference where there's some pain, doing compassion practice and doing forgiveness practice bring us in touch with the pain in a mindful way and tend to help us release it. So I would add that as a fourth core practice. So empathy practice, practicing with views, practicing with reactivity in different ways. We know a lot of that. And then heart practices, four fundamental ways to work with it. And of course, a willingness to learn from others. We can really ask ourselves, am I really willing to learn with and from another? Because the potential is, of course, I think many, if not most of us know this, is that when we approach differences in this open way, there's the potential of deepening relationships. And that when we don't do that, relationships either stay stuck or they actually lose their energy. I was talking with a friend earlier today, and she was mentioning how in a group she's leading, there was a difference that came up, and people chose in this group to embrace it and to work with it. And it resulted in a considerably increased level of closeness in the group, more trust, more willingness to be vulnerable, simply from working with a difference in a pretty small way. So that's the potential. So maybe I'll stop there and just invite any comments, stories, questions, maybe from your own experience with differences. And again, I think the starting point is to do this in our own lives. What would it be like if there was a cultural shift like this? I have some students who are teaching conflict work in the middle schools. We need this. You know, we need this deeply in the schools. We need this to be a basic training. It's not there in many ways. Like I said, even in our spiritual centers, alas, you know, but this is what really, I think, this is a core relational practice for us. And it's a way that we can really see our mindfulness practice, our heart practices, our practice with views, our compassion and empathy very much in action. So reflections, questions, thoughts on this. My invitation, of course, is for us to really do this and seek out differences, or seek out noticing them. Please. Was that Barbara?
Yeah, I could. I just appreciated your statement about conflict being an opportunity for learning experiences, because I think that implies a kind of self-transformation and a letting go of the self and a lot of something so much more alive than just saying who's going to win and who's going to lose. And it can be positive.
Say, what was your last thing?
It can be positive. I mean, you change.
That's the reframing.
Yes.
When we take this approach, we actually can get interested in conflicts. And of course, it helps if the other person has the same perspective.
Right. There's no real difference.
That's a big one. Right. But one can have this approach even if the other person doesn't. If the other person doesn't, if we're just talking about two people, it's harder to learn. But if both people have that approach, there is the possibility of learning, and one can actually be interested and even excited about conflict. Again, it goes against the conditioning so much. But we can be excited about that. What am I about to learn? There can be some fear. I think I mentioned when we were looking at fear that, with my conditioning around conflict, I've noticed sometimes that when I know I need to say something, even though it's uncomfortable, I start sometimes, in the past, I sometimes start shaking. Like it's a little bit scary to say what I need to say. But then, but I got to the point where I know if there's shaking, I better say it. Right, it's like this internal signal, but that shows that there can be fear, with going into the conflict. But the whole, when we have enough experience, we know that it's actually some way to actually deepen relationships, and it makes so much difference if there's shared perspectives on this and shared capacities. Yeah.
I wanted to say that I appreciated you softening conflict down to difference.
Yeah.
Conflict is so loaded,
That's right. Really key point, yeah. So even maybe hesitate to use the word conflict and to reframe it as difference is a crucial move. It was a crucial move for me. It could be a difference in values, difference in needs, difference in perspectives, but that's very helpful. I have a conflict with my partner about what we have for dinner, right? And can I just frame it as a difference? And then can we look for that win-win model? Or if not that, at least a compromise. We'll do it my way today, your way tomorrow. that can work. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, please, Linda. You're muted, Linda, sorry.
I had an experience with a woman who was going door to door with a something to sign, I'm sorry, petition. And it was something I definitely did not agree with. And I told her that was not something I agreed with. But then I told her, I said, but I so appreciate your being involved in our local government. And it really kind of felt like it was a connection that we made, because I do appreciate people being out there and being involved. It was a...
Yeah, Linda, that sounds very skillful, because if you say, I don't want to sign it, there might be initial disappointment, maybe a sense of, oh, we have different views. Yeah. And you went for connection. And sometimes that connection needs to be established more before there can actually be an exploration of differences. So that sounded very, very skillful.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt really good. And I think she felt good walking away from me. And she thanked me for saying that.
Yeah, I sometimes try that with telemarketers. Mm. Or people calling on political issues I disagree with, yeah. Liz, please.
I'm wondering if there's an element ever of renunciation in this, in the sense that, like, two countries are battling over territory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how one country could give that up. It would be a spiritual act to say, I'm going to give this land so there's no more fighting. But somehow I feel there's I haven't thought about this much, but an attitude of renunciation. I don't know if you want to pick up on that, but
yeah.
I recently had an episode with a cousin of mine, and we dearly love each other, so there was a basis of love there. I couldn't stand what she was saying and her attitude towards something. Mm-hmm. And with empathy, and she's a therapist, and she brought up needs, which completely almost resolved the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I had forgotten about needs, and I saw what her needs were. They weren't mine in that situation. But my need was to get along with this person I loved, so I needed to understand her. And when I did understand her, I could accept her attitude. I didn't change my mind on it, but I saw that she needed to do that, and I was willing to go along with it. But I think in some huge conflicts, there needs to be, miraculously, a renunciation. And I need to think about that.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to your own story of being able to see the need. That's, Galtung, Johann Galtung, with whom I studied, he actually has had significant impact on some international conflicts.
Really?
Yeah. And the practice is the same. You know, I've applied this, for example, the simple model I gave you can be applied quite easily to the Middle East. You know, and I think the analysis of needs is not too hard. The strategy to get there, to meet both needs, that's more complicated. But one can make, if one empathically tries to tune into the needs, that can be a basis for working with some even international conflicts. You know, we want to train at simpler levels. And then very crucial also to continue to distinguish between the underlying needs and the strategies. The strategies can be horrific, and they can be really, really crazy, right? Like in a lot of international conflicts.
Do you have an example of an international conflict that was resolved through thinking about needs?
Yeah. Yeah, the Galtung actually had a role in a conflict between Ecuador and Peru. And there was land that was in dispute at the, in the mountains in the Andes. And they had since I think the mid 19th century fought four wars around this land. And they despite the fact that the land, as far as I know, did not have, was top of the mountains, did not have people living there, and it had no natural resources. So it was more almost about, national pride or something like that. And some, at a certain point in the 1990s, they had just fought another war, I think 1991 or so. In the middle 90s, there were some of the young military, it may have been in both countries, but or maybe just from one country, they knew of Galtung's work. They asked him to consult. They thought having these wars was crazy, thousands of people dying. And so he led them into a way of seeing, can there be a both and resolution? And, I sometimes use this example when I teach on conflict. And invariably, when I describe the situation, there are some people who actually guess at the correct solution, or actually the solution that happened, which was to have, you could imagine different ways of resolving it. Again, always to have a ceasefire is always a good temporary step. But then they actually found that both sides agreed to have a jointly administered national park.
Wow, great.
They agreed on that. It's been a stable solution as far as I know. No more fighting, no more wars. Right? And it was through using this model that it actually worked.
Wonderful.
Quite a story, yeah.
You know, on a small level, yes, but an important level.
Yeah, smaller than, you know, Ukraine or something, but it's but it actually worked, and there had been four wars. It wasn't, you know, may appear small in some ways, but it wasn't small to them. Right? So
Thank you.
Maybe you have time for one or two more if anyone has one. Comment or question, sharing.
I just want to say, was there a sense of generosity in there somewhere?
There, the people involved were sort of disgusted. They were young officers disgusted by the wars. And so I think there was, probably aspects of wanting to be friends with their neighbors. There's an aspect of generosity there, I would think. And to really shift the, to shift out of, you know, a militaristic approach. That's my sense.
I'd love to jump in.
Okay, please. Maybe last one. Yeah.
Okay. So many years ago, Donald and I were talking about conflict in a particularly difficult relationship. And you gave me some reflection, Donald, that I've never forgotten, that has been a very important piece of perspective. And what Donald said to me was, tune into her pain and you'll be in your right mind. Tune into her pain and you'll be in your right mind. And it was such a poignant, timely piece of feedback, because what I want is to be in my right mind. And I feel that this is where the Dharma brings us, is into our hearts and into our minds to act in a skillful, kind way. And I've never forgotten it. And it was that piece of empathy to start there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, thank you, Heidi. And again, it's so the invitation is to practice this, knowing that conflicts and differences will tend to take us out of our right mind. Through our conditioning, through our background, just to know that. So you can almost, my invitation for the next few weeks, so I come back on July 3rd, Heidi will be teaching next week. My invitation is to take differences, whether with a person in your life or even the difference, maybe you hear someone talking on the radio, like I was saying, can you try to be empathic towards what's there? Again, take it as a starting point for practice. When there is a sense of a difference or a conflict, use those four tools: empathy, tuning into emotions, and underlying needs, distinguishing needs from strategies. Number two, practicing when there are attachment to views, looking for attachment to views. Number three, practicing with different forms of reactivity. And then fourthly, bringing in the heart practices. You know, and if there is like an interpersonal conflict, compassion, exactly what Heidi was bringing up, tuning into the pain of another, compassion practice, it will tend to take us out of our attachment to our view. Compassion will tend to say, oh, there's pain here, and will bring us to our Dharma right mind, so to speak. So that's the invitation for next time. How many of you would like to take that on, to bring more practice with differences? No pressure. And so, yeah, and let's set the intention now. How might you do that? How might you remember to practice in this way in the next few weeks? What's going to help you remember? What's your larger intention for doing this?